You're tuned to Perspectives, a weekly public affairs show which airs every Saturday right here on KTEP. And joining us today on Perspectives is author James Elroy, and we're going to talk about his latest novel, Perfidia. First of all, I'd like to thank James Elroy for being with us here today. He has spent decades capturing gritty, noirish, scary, dark Los Angeles and sprawling crime novels such as Black Dahlia and L.A. Confidential. And first of all, again, thank you, James, for being with us. James Elroy.
Hey, Louie. What's shaking, Big Daddy-O?
I like that intro. Thank you very much. Nothing shaking here, and it's still hot in El Paso.
Yeah, I was in Dallas, Big D, and Houston not long ago. In fact, it was at the beginning of last week on my tumultuous Perfidia book tour. And it was so hot, I saw a dog chasing a cat. And they were both walking. You've heard it before.
Maybe our listeners haven't. That's a good one.
It is a good one.
Yes.
Feel free to use it.
I will. Thank you. With your permission. Now, this novel, Perfidia, is a historical novel about Pearl Harbor or the Pearl Harbor Day. Tell us a little bit first about your interest in history, because historical novels seems to be like your forte, and you've been interested in history for quite a while.
Yeah, what I've done is merge the crime novel and the historical novel in books like The Black Dahlia, The Big Nowhere, L.A. Confidential, White Jazz, American Tabloid. Perfidia is a 700-page novel told in real time and entirely within the month of December 1941. Begins the day before the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor and ends on December 29th. And it's largely the story of the early days of the grave injustice of the Japanese internment.
A lot of people, when they think of Pearl Harbor or a novel about Pearl Harbor, documentaries, whatever it may be, they automatically think Pearl Harbor, Hawaii, the USS Arizona. But you set your story in Los Angeles.
Yeah, I'm from L.A., and as a pundit once told me 40 years ago, L.A., come on vacation, go home on probation. And so I live here. It's where I go when women divorce me. And it's a life sentence for me. And I succumb to this life sentence, and I serve it gratefully and dutifully. And Perfidia is the first volume of my second L.A. quartet. First L.A. quartet, Black Dahlia, Big Nowhere, L.A. Confidential, and White Jazz, was set in L.A. between 1946 and 1958. And this quartet takes characters from the first body of work and places them in L.A. during World War II as younger people. So it's what they call a prequel in that sense. I live history. I love history. I've always escaped into history. I don't have a cell phone. I don't have a computer. I've written all 19 of my books by hand. And I live it. I describe history as a state of yearning. I live in a state of yearning for history itself, and I would call Perfidia a historical romance more than anything else.
When you tell us about your writing and you don't have a cell phone or a computer, a lot of people are going, what? As a writer, people would think, this is a huge novel. You write huge novels, and yet you're writing by hand?
Yes. What? I've never learned to type. I've avoided the digital age. It's incomprehensible to me. God knows I'm beset by enough anxiety without having to deal with the constant interruption of emails and text messages. And this is the way the world works for me. I'm talking to you now here in Los Angeles on a landline telephone with a cord. And I'll do anything to simplify my life, and it allows me to sustain concentration and write these big books of mine.
I think in one of the interviews you did with NPR, I believe it was, you said that you, in some ways, you compare yourself to some of the great composers, like Beethoven, writing music.
Well, I can't say that I'm the American Beethoven in the historical novel field. Nobody was ever Beethoven. But I've listened to Beethoven for 50 years, and my identification with the man is profound. And I hooked myself onto his stars as a boy. And if you want to hook yourself onto a great artist and have a great artist as your guru or your exemplar, go right to the top, and Beethoven is the top.
Speaking of music, James, in the era of World War II and 1940s, it was the era of the big bands and jazz music. A lot of people listened to the radio, and radio was the key. It was, they listened to radio dramas, they listened to music, and of course they heard, you know, President Roosevelt talk about Pearl Harbor. So in talking about your music, and do you listen to that while you're writing?
No, I don't. I have, you know, I'm talking to you from my office here in my house, and I have a music room next door, and I have a very good stereo system, and a couple of Eames chairs, and framed Deutsche Grammophon album covers on the walls, and busts of Beethoven, and I listen there.
People kept themselves, I guess, occupied during that time because we have been fortunate that the wars, besides the Civil War, have been fought over the oceans and not on the home front. But Perfidia takes place on the home front. And you wanted to, I guess you wanted your readers to experience World War II on the home front?
Yes, World War II is a character in Perfidia. And all the action takes place in Los Angeles. And so with the war as a character, people are constantly reacting to it. They're consumed by it. They're afraid of it. L.A. was under imminent threat of Japanese sea and air attack. Great patriotic fervor, you know, was issued just a heartbeat away from vile racial animus directed at largely innocent Japanese Americans. From there, the grave injustice of the Japanese internment commenced. It's a romantic era. It's a time of big ideals, big passions, big love, big hate, big belief, and big stakes. And these are the stuff of big novels.
What about the internment? You know, that's a dark chapter in our history, and you bring the reader to it. And for the benefit of our listener, would you briefly kind of take us through that period?
Yes. You look at geopolitics in the late 1930s into the 1940s. Japan is on a rampage. They did vile, vile things. I mean, unspeakable things in the rape of Nanking. So the rounding up of largely innocent Japanese Americans is understandable, but not justified. The feds had a list of allegedly subversive Japanese Americans, rounded them up, seized their property, and in February of 1942 started shipping them to internment camps throughout the Pacific Northwest, California, I mean, as far east as Arkansas. And it was less than a pogrom, but what it was a blood libel. And it was indiscriminate in that the target was Japanese Americans while we were still at war with Germany and Italy. And German and Italian bloodlines are diffuse. You can't tell a German or an Italian just by looking at them. And so those people went uninterned. I mean, there was some internment in the First World War of Germans and sporadic attempts to intern them during World War II. But it wasn't mechanized and systematic the way the Japanese internment was. They started letting the people out in 1943, and the men were allowed to enlist in the army. Some refused. They were called the no-no boys. A lot of property was lost. A lot of financial traction was lost. People died in the internment camps of natural causes and did not get to see their loved ones, or many of their loved ones, during their declining days. It's a bad, bad deal.
James, writing historical fiction is not easy because even though it's a fictional story, because it's historical, you have to be accurate with your facts and do your research. When you look at these stories and writing something as huge as Perfidia, did you have to go around and interview perhaps some of the relatives, loved ones of some of these Japanese people?
I hate research. I mean, I hire somebody to do it for me. What I want is the fictional latitude.
Okay.
What I want is, okay, this happened, this happened, this happened. This didn't happen. This gives me the latitude to invent it. In the end, it's fiction. It comes down to how well can you make it up.
One of the things in Perfidia is proximity. It takes place in L.A., but it also takes place in a general area.
Takes place where?
In a general area.
Where?
Everything is close together,
oh, yes.
The proximity?
Yeah, oh yeah, everything was, it's all downtown L.A., Chinatown, adjoined Little Tokyo, the Chinese and the Japanese hated each other, the LAPD's detective bureau was there, the Roseco Parkway, which leads to Highland Park, which leads to the murder scene of the Watanabe family, that's all there, yeah.
People like murder mysteries, they like thrillers, and murder is at the heart of this novel.
Yes.
Can you tell us a little bit about that?
In the hours preceding the Pearl Harbor attack, family of four, Ryoshi Watanabe, Aya, Johnny, and Nancy Watanabe, the last two are the kids, are murdered in their Hancock Park pad. Looks like suicide at first. Seppuku, ritual Japanese suicide. What is it? What is proximity again? What is the nearness of the bombing date? What does it mean? Are these fifth columnists? Are these traitors? Are they supporters of Imperial Japan? Are they loyal Americans? Read Pit Perfidia, and more will be revealed.
You could call this, and well, it is, a hate crime. And we talk about, we read about hate crimes going on today.
That's not a hate crime.
It's not a hate crime?
Nah, it's not a hate crime. Hate crimes, that's a 2014 appellation. And this is not that. There is a complex web of psychosexual, racial, and geopolitical motive attached to the murder of these four people. Once again, read Perfidia, and more will be revealed.
The book itself, as you mentioned, is part two of the L.A. Quartet. And in the book, My Dark Places, it's very personal to you, and people may not be aware of all this. Would you mind sharing that with us?
On June 22nd, 1958, when my mother was murdered, I was 10 years old. It remained unsolved. I went back in 1994 and reinvestigated the case with a retired L.A. County Sheriff's homicide detective. We did not find the killer. The book is about, thematically, my search for my mother. And this is what sparked my interest in L.A.'s social history, criminal history, all of it.
You've talked in interviews about My Dark Places, and in there you compare your parents to movie stars.
Well, I said they were a great-looking, cheap couple along the lines of Robert Mitchum and Jane Russell in Macau. It was just a throwaway line.
Okay. Once again, in the history, getting back to Perfidia, because we want people to jump into this book. It's a huge book, 608 pages.
700.
Okay.
Yeah.
But the fact that, you know, sometimes with the Kindles, the e-readers, and they get engaged in this book and they don't realize how thick it is, how big it is. But it's what some people would call a quick read, not that you can read it in 20 minutes or a couple hours, but because you get so engaged in it and it's so well written, that it's fast paced, that people can get engaged in this without realizing how big the book is.
You got to fall into this book. You've got to assume that you have no life outside of reading this book. You've got to neglect your romantic partners, neglect your kids. Make sure the dog has water in his dish and take the dog for a nice walk and then tie one on with a couple of strong cups of coffee or bracing ginger ales. And sit down and read. You know, Hepcats, it's World War II. Everything old is new again. There is no TV. There is no internet. There's big band music on the radio. FDR just excoriated Japan for perpetrating the Day of Infamy. You're afraid you're going to be drafted. You're afraid there's Japanese submarines out there on the bay. You're afraid of air attack. But in the meantime, go out and buy my book and read it, and do it now.
In reading this book and looking at history. It's also an engagement for not just young people, but people in general who may not be interested in history or not really read historical books. But when they see that it's a novel, they tend to forget that it's history and they're learning something, and they jump into this and they get involved with the characters, as you mentioned. So you have, gosh, a lot of characters in this book. Your characters are well-described, well-dressed women. Everything that's going on, you feel like you are living the World War II era in the home front.
That's the highest compliment you can pay me, and I'm grateful for it. I want to take people back. I want to take people back to December 1941 and uproot them from their lives, their daily routines, and make them read the book in fewer settings rather than numerous settings, so that they might be as obsessed as I was when I wrote the book. I want to create an obsessive writer-reader bond. That's my design.
What was it that brought everyone together during the World War II era and after the war, with victory parades and everybody was very patriotic? What unified the country like that, James? Was it because of the attack on Pearl Harbor?
A monstrous common enemy, the Axis forces, genocidal madmen, all. And it was up to us to put the skids to it. And when the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor, they crossed the line. And Admiral Yamamoto said, following the attack, "What I fear we have done is to waken a sleeping giant and fill him with a terrible resolve." And he was right.
What would you tell us, James, you as a history buff and a historical fiction writer?
About Franklin Roosevelt?
Yes.
He was certainly right at the top of our list of great presidents. Truth is, he was waffling about getting into the war. Winston Churchill, who would go on to become FDR's great ally, quipped, "You can trust America to do the right thing after they've tried everything else." We waffled right up until the moment those eggs dropped on Pearl, and then we got involved.
When we got involved, one of the things is, why did we allow Russia to do what they did? And if you read the history book, some of them say, well, President Roosevelt wanted Russia to stay in the war and to help defeat the Germans, and that's the only way it could have been done, with us enticing Russia to go along with England and ourselves.
Well, no, Hitler invaded Russia on June 22nd, 1941, and Russia was in it whether they wanted to be, whether we were in it or not. They were the stalking horse for the 1944 American and British invasion of, you know, Germany, you know, Normandy, D-Day. And the question remains, why didn't we go in after Stalin when we had the chance after the end of the war? I mean, we knew how evil he was, and that's a remaining mystery. Churchill wanted to do it. Churchill and Patton wanted to go in and wipe out Russia. Think of the benefits of that. No Cold War, no Soviet aggression.
Without the Cold War and heading into the Cold War, I guess a lot of people wonder to what would have and what ifs. What ifs is, as somebody said, Don Meredith from the Dallas Cowboys said, if ifs and buts were candy and nuts, we'd all be home for Christmas. And as you mentioned, why didn't we go after Stalin after the war? Did President Eisenhower... was he as cautious as President Truman was?
You know what? I don't know.
Okay.
The truth is, I'm concerned with World War II right now.
Uh-huh.
And what I do is I localize my curiosity. You know, I'm done with December 1941. I'm going on with January through July in 1942. And when we talk for the second book in this series, I can address 1942.
Are you planning to go on through the end of the war and the
second
bombing?
The LA Quartet goes up through VJ Day, August 1945.
That would be very interesting to discuss as well, because, of course, the testing of the Manhattan Project was not too far away from here.
That's right.
And some people say that when they tested that bomb, you could feel the tremors and the lights. Everything was so bright, even here as far as El Paso.
Well, I have a photograph downstairs in the dining room from 1953, and so albeit in black and white, and it's downtown L.A., all lit up because there was an A-bomb blast, 250 miles away in the Nevada desert. And to this day, I think the A-bomb is cool.
When you're writing a book like this, and it's a massive book, as you mentioned, and you've warned the readers already what to do before they sit down and read it, how do you know when to end it, James?
I just do. I write huge outlines. I understand the emotional texts of my books. I understand the geopolitical text. I understand the plot text and the mechanisms that are necessary to tie it all together into a satisfying emotional intellectual whole, and I just know, because I've been doing this for a while.
When we talked about the Japanese internment, can you tell us a little bit about what happened with these people? I know you don't want to talk about the end of the war, but some don't know about their treatment. They don't know what was going on in those internment camps. Can you kind of brief us a little bit about that?
Well, you know, this was not the Soviet Gulag or the Holocaust. Dare I say, their civil liberties were abrogated, the people who were interned. Families were largely kept together. They lived in barracks. They did work. They did a lot of farming that led to great advances in fields of architecture. There were privileges. It was jail. Is what it was. It was jail with, you know, a form of outdoor work furlough where you couldn't leave the compound. Sometimes you could. Sometimes you could go work in neighboring farms. And you were fed and you were housed in inhospitable climates, dare I say. You know, Manzanar in the Owens Valley, bad, bad summers, even worse winters. That's what it was like.
In your book, Perfidia, one of the characters in the LAPD is a Japanese.
Uh-huh. He's not a sworn policeman. He's a forensic chemist, yes. Hideo Ishida.
Can you tell us a little bit about kind of the atmosphere in the LAPD and the treatment towards this officer, and then, the chemist, and then also the fact that there's the other, the sergeant, Dudley Smith.
All right. Now, Dudley Smith is an Irish emigre, an ex-IRA killer, and a fledgling war profiteer. Hideo Ishida is a closet homosexual, Japanese-American forensic chemist with three PhDs at the age of 24. He's the only Japanese in any way associated with the Los Angeles Police Department. He's up against institutional racism. He's in a boatload, you-know-what, as soon as the eggs drop on Pearl Harbor. And the Watanabe case looms as his way out of the terrible political and personal dilemma that he's in.
Speaking of political dilemmas, Sergeant Smith is, for lack of a better word, I guess, he's kind of worming his way around the police department, and he does stuff that... if anybody else did it, would be arrested.
Right.
Was it hard to develop this kind of character? I mean, you read about these characters, and you see them in the old movies where the policemen are corrupt or crooked or they do something wrong, and people are saying, well, you know, World War II, this was a time where people were together. They paint, as you talk about your picture downstairs, they paint a glossy picture of the war and everything that was going on at home, and Perfidia paints a completely different picture.
Perfidia shows the nobility of the time. Perfidia is a love song to America during World War II. It is also a bitter Valentine, and the lives, whenever you have a great public event, there are people have to exploit it, and that's Dudley Smith. And I'm exploiting history with this book. I didn't live through it. I didn't serve in World War II. I wasn't born, but I made more than a few bucks off of it already, and I'm nothing but grateful.
James, for the benefit of our audience, do you have a website that they can go to, or should they just go through Amazon or any other book dealer to get the book?
I would go through Amazon or wherever you go to your local bookstore, you're going to find it.
Well, James, thank you very much for taking the time out of your busy schedule to be with us today. We have been visiting with James Elroy, author of the new novel. Actually, it's not that new. It's a couple of months old. Perfidia. But it's a great book, and it's about the Pearl Harbor era, that month in December. And you can find it, of course, at your local bookstore or anywhere else. And James, thank you again for being with us.
Louis, thank you. God bless you.
God bless you. You have a great day.
Bye.
The genius of playing a genius. I'm Bill Newcott, and from AARP Studios, this is Movies for Grownups.
You see how the men's shirts glow more than the women's dresses?
Yes.
Do you know why?
Why?
Tide.
The washing powder.
The fluorescence in the washing powder is caught by the UV light.
Why do you know that?
Eddie Redmayne and Felicity Jones star as the legendary astrophysicist Stephen Hawking and his wife Jane in the new film, The Theory of Everything. There's a good chance you'll see both of them on the red carpet come Oscar night, and at the Movies for Grownups Film Showcase in Los Angeles, they told our audience about the challenges of playing two famous people who are still very much alive.
We both met Stephen and Jane and Jonathan and the children. It was really quite...
Yeah, it was about a couple of weeks before we started shooting. So we were just hoping that preparations had been in the right direction.
That was the fear, because you do these months of preparation and you had to in some way have mapped out a sense of the arc of the characters. But fortunately, I think in both of our cases, when we met the people we were playing, it just gave us this added final element. With Stephen, it was the thing that you absolutely took away from meeting him was this, like, this sort of razor wit and wondrous humour, but also this kind of mischievous quality. This I describe it as like a Lord of Misrule quality. He like absolutely controls a room, and he has a sort of, there's a glint in his eye, and that was kind of the last element that I try to bring to him.
Yeah, someone asked him, Stephen, what is the biggest mystery in the world? And there was a pause, and he just typed, women. But that tells you, yeah. He has this amazing just wit, doesn't he? This way with words.
The Theory of Everything, starring Eddie Redmayne and Felicity Jones, is in theaters. I'm Bill Newcott.
Perspectives is taped and produced at the KTP Studios, University of Texas at El Paso Communication Building. Our thanks to our engineer, Norma Martinez. Our producer is Dennis Wu. You've been tuned to Perspectives. I'm Louis Sines.